Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. My name is Alan Pfeiffer, and it's my pleasure just quickly to introduce this evening a very, very important set of panelists here that are going to speak about a topic that's near and dear to all of us. And I want to thank you. Let me briefly introduce the panelists, and then I will get out of the way. Rabbi Rothwax is our moderator, and Rabbi Rothwax is a licensed social worker. He is the rabbi at Congregation Beth Aaron in Teaneck since the year 2002. Before that, he was also a rebbe. He's been a rebbe for a very long time at YMJ and MTA. He's the head rabbi at Camp Morasha, and he also, since 2016, he has served as director of professional rabbinics at REITS, at Yeshiva University. And he is going to be making a very important move to Israel in a number of years and will be the founding rabbi of Merome Shemesh, which is a new community in Ramat Beit Shemesh. He's a graduate of YU and Azrieli and Wurzweiler and, of course, REITS. Rabbi Blass is a mashkiach ruchani at REITS, where he meets literally day and night with our students, and it guides them through everything they deal with, including, obviously, very importantly, shiduchim. And he's a former pulpit rabbi, a licensed therapist as well, and an incredibly insightful individual. Next, we have Dr. Miriam Adler. I'm Pesach. Rabbi Adler is here as support.
He's a very good husband.
He's our husband. Dr. Adler is a licensed clinical psychologist and the executive director of Clifton Psychotherapy and Neurofeedback Associates, where she supervises a multidisciplinary team of therapists, and she draws upon over 20 years of experience as a clinician and presented at numerous professional conferences. She has a wide range of specialty areas, including advanced training in marriage and relationship counseling, resolution of trauma and family attachment wounds, and anxiety, OCD. She works with singles during their dating years to overcome anxiety and emotional blocks. And last but not least is Malki Galler. Malki is a hero in the, it's not part of a bio, it's me ad-libbing, in the world of shidduchim. She's made over 60 couples, engagements, and I have a hard time doing one or two. It's absolutely astounding. She's an associate staff connector and works as a matchmaker for YU Connects. And she's done many singles initiatives, including the Young Israel Woodmere. And she just recently joined the staff to be able to dedicate even more of her time. I think she works maybe 20 hours a day on Shidduchim. So I'll pass the microphone over to Rabbi Rothwax and get started.
Thank you.
I forgot actually a really, really important thing to say. Really important. You know, YU Connects is funded through the generosity of individuals like the people here in this room, but we're having a really critical, important matching campaign through Cause Match, which is being launched on April 7th and 8th. So in just less than 2 weeks, please look out for that and share it with anyone you can. All dollars will be doubled, so it's really important that you please help support, and thank you very much for your support.
Thank you, Alan. Good evening, everybody, and it's a pleasure to welcome you all, for Shus, Marina Hasra, and of course, the Revitzin, Dr. Sabalowski, who does so much work on behalf of YU Connects. It's a privilege to be here tonight with our three esteemed panelists. I'd like to take the opportunity to sort of briefly review what's going to happen tonight as I am moderating, which I guess means that I am the moderate voice in the room, which is not usually the case, so it's good to know that tonight I am. You know, there's much discussion, as we know, and maybe from time to time, each and every one of us, some more, some less, participate in the discussion where we point out all that's wrong or that's not as right as it should be about the shidduch process. I try not to refer to shidduch crisis as an entity, as a fact, although many people certainly have experienced what feels to be a crisis within their own lives, whether themselves personally or members of their family. But I think we would all agree that when it comes to the Shemitah process, there are problems. There are aspects. There are features of the process, the way it exists, which are in need of improvement and repair. I think that before we even get started tonight, it is important to note that the mere fact that we are having a conversation like this, the fact that so many of you have come to join this evening, and you just heard just a little sample of the wonderful work that YConnex does on behalf of the community, is an example of what's right, what's good about the Shiva process, and I think it's something that we should all be very proud of. This is not part of a commercial for YConnex. I wasn't asked to say this, but I do really think whatever our personal experiences have been, we have to just really take a step back and say, well, really, ashrenu, that we have an organization in our midst that organizes events like this and brings us together for conversations like this, which is so incredibly important. My job tonight is to keep this conversation going. I have already instructed our panelists to try to keep their remarks, relatively short and to the point, and that's not because I'm afraid that they're going to talk too long or that they have nothing to say. Quite to the contrary, I think we could really be here for hours and hours, even if only one of them would respond to any one of the questions. I am hoping that tonight is the start of new conversations, but it's not intended to be the end of conversations. So for those of you who are expecting to have, no pun intended, because we haven't started the conversation, clarity tonight, I'm hoping that things may be somewhat clearer, but I think we just need to set our expectations from the outset. I have no idea if our panelists are going to agree on all the points. We have not really reviewed notes in that regard. And I'll be honest, I'm hoping that they don't, because what will make this a more productive and, frankly, just a more genuine conversation is if we don't necessarily agree on all of the details and all the points, we all agree on the objective, we agree on where we're trying to get over here and what we're hoping to accomplish with this conversation. Clarity within the dating process is something which probably means different things to different people. Several of my own children who noticed that my name was, associated with this event started laughing and making fun of me, because I have told them on numerous occasions, particularly through their dating process, that there's no such thing as clarity in dating. So when you say, I'm just waiting for clarity, I would say to them, there's really no clarity. Is just this thing that it's a word that we use, we make it up when we think we're looking for something that we may never find, and when we find what we think we're looking for, we say, oh, I have found clarity. Now, that may not be so. We're going to hear from our panelists tonight, but I personally think that there is tremendous value in having this conversation, because it seems to me as if many of our young men and women, and perhaps parents as well, people of all different stages and ages and involved in this process, sometimes struggle in an attempt to figure out what's happening here. What am I feeling? What am I thinking? What should I be thinking? What should I be feeling? And in this regard, I think tonight's conversation is very, very important. The most difficult part is going to be for me to be quiet. I'm going to really, really try to just stick to my script, which is to be moderate and ask the questions. I reserve the right, if that's okay, to interject a thought here and there, but for the most part, I'm really excited to hear what our incredible panelists have to say. So I'm going to actually begin. We've sort of set an outline for ourselves and broken this conversation down into three parts. We'll see how it goes. The first one is gaining clarity during dating. And I'd like to begin, if that's okay, by asking a question to Dr. Adler. What does gaining clarity in a relationship mean in the context of dating? At least in your opinion, what does it mean to gain clarity?
Well, now I'm very deflated because there is no clarity and I know nothing of what I see.
Right.
But the illusion of clarity is important. And I wanted to start with an adage which we, most of us, may be familiar with, which we see in the Mishonim. Ein simcha kehataras hasfekos. There is no joy similar to the feeling of resolution of doubt. And it's kind of an interesting way of speaking about things. We could understand, I would think, it's good for your blood pressure. It relieves stress to resolve doubt. But the wording of that it creates a sense of joy, I think really speaks to how important it is. It's part of the human experience, kind of in the human DNA. That all of us really want to feel like we have direction. We want to feel like we know where we're going and what makes sense for ourselves. And there's a simcha that comes with that. There's a simcha that comes with having a sense of direction. In fact, not having it can create such an internal crisis, can be so unnerving and disorienting and even for many people kind of torturous, that when we finally feel we have clarity, it feels happy. It's like its own bria of an experience. Today's generation, I find, like with the young people, they often like almost think in memes. So if we have like a meme of somebody who's in that kind of like angsty state, it's, you know, kind of like pulling out their hair, can't eat, can't sleep, doesn't know what to do. Their parents are probably also pulling out their hair. And then when they have that clarity, it's like, ah, okay, this is where I'm going. And, you know, like the American Express advertisement, or I don't know if it's still there, it used to be, that's priceless. That feeling of knowing where we're going with a relationship or with anything important is priceless. Of course, the million-dollar question is how to get there. There are two points that I think are important just for starting the conversation about clarity, I guess, like from a psychological perspective. One of them is that, both of them are stylistic in terms of respecting people's styles. One is that while emotion and logic are both important, I mean, I think all of us, like if our head is on straight, we agree, shouldn't marry somebody who you don't have emotional connection to, and you shouldn't marry someone where it like literally makes absolutely no sense. Okay. But some people are driven more by their logic. Like they will not have clarity until in their mind, like all the I's are dotted, all the T's are crossed, they can really see how the trajectory is going to be with that person. And there are other people where their clarity is led by emotions, that they need to have a certain level of emotional connection before they'll be able to feel like they had clarity. Not that both aren't important, but what drives the person. The other main point, I think, is in terms of what the experience feels like inside. For the vast majority of people, I think, from my experience, it's actually not how it was for me, but for most of my clients and friends, it's kind of like the eyeglass experiment. Like, you know, we go to the eye doctor and we read the charts and, you know, A, B, C, but it's not in order because we can't guess. We have to be able to read it. And as we get closer to the right prescription, we are more sure of our answers. We're not saying like, I think it's an A, it might be a C. It's like, that's an A. I read that right. And we have a sense of clarity until we finally, you know, are looking through the right lenses and we say like, that is the right prescription for me. And then there's like always the OCD kid, not diagnostically OCD, but you know, the more nervous kid that's like, could I just like look at the last line, like the last lens again? Maybe I like the way the B looked better there. Maybe I like the way the D looked better there. It's like they kind of have clarity, but they need to go back and forth and back and forth until they really feel sure. And then there are people who it doesn't feel incremental like that for. It just feels like, whoa, you know, like in the movies. When they finally get clarity at, it could be after a long time, or it could be even on a first or second date, but when they have that clarity, it doesn't feel incremental. It feels like a lightning bolt, and they feel sure. As far as I know and can see, and what I see anecdotally as well, there is no research that I'm aware of that shows that any way of coming to clarity results in a happier marriage, as long as there were no red flags that you ignored. But people just have different styles of what they need to feel secure, if it's fake security, but to feel secure. But there is research, and this is what I'll end on, there is research that's showing that having the experience internally of coming to clarity, having an actual conversation about whether this makes sense for you or not, in one way or the other, does correlate greatly with marital satisfaction. There was a research study done, they have cute names, they call it sliders and deciders. Sliders just kind of slide from one part of the relationship to the next. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, nothing's wrong. They want to drop the shotgun. Great, we'll drop the shotgun. They want to do, oh yeah, it makes sense to get engaged. Okay, we'll get engaged. Next thing they know, they're married. And deciders at each step of the way, like think about it. For somebody who makes quick decision, it could be a 15-minute conversation with their mom. For somebody who is a little more obsessive, it could be months of thinking about it. Not dropping the shotgun, that can't go for months, but until they're ready to make a decision. But they have had the experience in their memory bank of thinking through, does this make sense and is this what I want for myself? And what's interesting about the study is that they say their actual marriage objectively may not be any better or worse. They may have the same amount of arguments and the same amount of differences and the same amount of positive experiences, but the person who went through the experience of knowing that they made a decision, like this girl, this boy is for me, this is good, their internal experience is much more positive. They own the decision, and they feel that whatever comes their way is part of what was meant for them. Like, they own it. It's part of the way they frame it in their mind is that this was meant to be, and they end up being happier. So I think that speaks, again, to the importance of conversations like these, where we really encourage our daters to have those kind of conversations about clarity and to be able to have a feeling inside of themselves that they own their decision and they didn't just kind of slide into it or slide out of it.
Thank you very much. Rabbi Bless, we heard from Alan, but I think we all know that you spent so much time with our young men in the Beis Medrash, literally and figuratively, speaking with them about their struggles, but specifically, not only, but partially and to a large degree, through the prism of Torah. And wondering if you could share some perspectives and thoughts as to what degree Torah informs this conversation in general, in your interactions with young men and perhaps young women as well, along their dating journeys. What can we, you know, take from our tradition, from Torah values, if you will, to help us inform us on this issue?
No, it's okay. First of all, thank you, Rabbi Rothwax. And I also want to piggyback on just one thing that Rabbi Rothwax said and that Alan mentioned. Thank you. And that's really to express pride in how much work goes on in NYU overall in Shidduchim. Collaboration between Mashgichim, Rebbeim, therapists, YU Connects, WhatsApp groups, and sort of constant conversations of working with students, hours and hours. It's not just the hundreds of Shidduchim that were made, but it's all the collaboration of all the different pieces of the YU system. And it's really a beautiful time for all the perhaps, you know, complaining of crises, but it's a beautiful time of collaboration and work together. Rather, just to maybe address your question, you know, there's obviously Torah perspectives that inform everything, every piece, especially relationships. I know for me, there's a few different Mar Mikomos, a few different sources that I like to turn to when dealing with students that are in this place of stuckness, right? In this place of, I really care about this person. I'm excited. Am I excited enough? How excited do I need to be? Oh, 3 days ago, I'm ready to get engaged. And now today, I'm just like, oh gosh, it's like the biggest decision of my life. And I'm sure Dr. Adler and Malki also, you know, this is sort of like the constant push and pull of uncertainty that a person navigates in relationships. And it is torturous for young men and young women, especially if a person has netiya towards being more like an anxious personality in the first place. I just want to mention two Mar Mikomos I always found meaningful in helping students navigate this issue. So one Mar Mikom is from Revolvi. Revolvi, you know, is really the Rebbe of all sort of human growth and insight. And he mentions, quoting Rabbeinu Tam, that when a person is uncertain of who they want to be in regards to learning, how much do I want to learn, how much do I want to be committed, he says, Yavo haseichel, let the brain come and make a decision. Not every decision is I feel like or I don't feel like, I'm excited, I'm not excited. Sometimes it's like the seichel can come and say, well, is this like a thoughtful, meaningful decision that I can make in my life? Of course, I need to be somewhat excited as well, but it's not all riding a wave of emotion and excitement. It's allowing the seichel to come and allowing the seichel to make a decision. And not to go through every piece of that process, I want to leave time for other people, but I try to sit down with students that are struggling and saying, let's remove this a little bit from the place of the complicated emotions, and let's make up a list of 5 questions. Can you answer these 5 questions? Do I enjoy being with the person? Am I attracted to the person? Do we have shared values? Is this person going to be, in my estimation, a good wife and mother? Is this a growth-oriented person? If you can answer yes to those 5 questions, then you have as good of a chance as anybody else of building for the next 70, 80 years a great marriage. And once they sort of have that down on a piece of paper in the place of sort of seichel and thoughtfulness, then that like removes this whole burden of what am I feeling and am I feeling something enough or not? That's one Mar Mikom to keep in mind. So another Mar Mikom, on the pasuk of Rabbis Machshavas Belev Ish, Atzas Hashem Hitakum, what does it mean, Atzas Hashem Hitakum? The Eitzah of God will be preserved or will be left standing, so to speak. So the Vilna Gaon says so beautifully on the pasuk in Mishle, he says, when a person is thinking of a decision in their own mind,
what should I do, how should I do it, how much should I do, that often comes sort of to nothing because we get so caught in our own brain of decision-making processes that are so complicated. But he says, "Avatzas Hashem, ha'etza shenason ha'kadosh baruch hu b'leiv ha'adam." The etza, the deeper insight that a person might have, that maybe comes from God or from the soul, that is hitakum tiskayem. Namely, if I can clear away from my sort of cerebral cortex of the complexity of decisions, and I must go deeper inside of myself. What do I want? Like, what's my soul telling me? What's my gut telling me? Can I access almost a deeper knowledge that goes beyond sometimes like the stickiness of the brain? Then can we sort of clear out all the noise of our life and descend into that place where truth really sort of really lies? So there's many other sort of Torah insights, but those are two of the ones that I go to. Obviously, let the seichel come and make a decision, get things down on a piece of paper, and also allowing a person to sort of dive deeper into themselves. Like, what do I really want in my gut? You know, pro or con. And often, if a person can access that sort of deeper knowledge, that deeper chokhmah, the chokhmah's elyon, that often sort of points a light, so to speak, in the darkness of the indecisiveness of relationships.
Thank you. And I guess finally, for the last open question for this part of the conversation, I'll turn to Malki. We've already heard she's quite the expert when it comes to Shidduchim.
A hero.
Leonora,
hero.
60 and Bez Hashem anymore. Practically speaking, you must encounter this a lot. We just all have to assume. You're not just thinking the idea, but you're really shepherding everyone through the process. So what steps either do you take, or how can you advise daters and or parents who are here tonight as well about how to work through their own insecurities, the feelings of the lack of clarity, because that's what you're here to talk about tonight, that they encounter in their developing relationships?
My voice is definitely not loud enough. I just wanted to just start off by thanking Robinson Sadlowski for inviting me here. She is really our esteemed leader, and I'm very, very proud to call her my friend, and to really also, it's really an honor to be here with such esteemed panelists. And so to answer your question, and I'm not going to, I'm going to be very practical right now with my answers, because we've heard a lot of the philosophical background of what clarity, you know, what it looks like, how we get there, the five questions, the logic versus the emotion. So I'm just going to say, like, very practically speaking, when a dater will come to me and they'll say, you know, what are some practical things that I can do to gain clarity? And in my mind, I'm giving them a very practical answer of what the dates are looking like. So what I usually say is, after a few dates, after the first few dates maybe, stop dating in the very typical way, because life is not about coffee and board game cafes and, you know, mini golf. Life is really very practical. And so I say, like, do life things together. Maybe take a sibling shopping for school supplies at Target. Maybe do your mom's grocery shopping for Shabbos. Maybe cook a Shabbos meal together. Go to the bank. Do errands. Do real life things. And you're going to start to see, and maybe it's the seichel, maybe it's the emotion, I'm not sure exactly, the logic, maybe it's the emotion. You're going to start to feel that thing, this is how it's going to feel like with this person. And just to build on that, we really found over COVID took a real hit to the dating world, and we were all of a sudden like, what do we do? How do we date? Where do we go? Where do we go was the number one question. Everyone was in pods and in cohorts, and I don't even know why. But so people started dating in their homes. Everyone got the fire pit in the back, and people were renting out their homes. And we really found that dating, you know, obviously after a few dates, dating in your home is actually smart and affordable and valuable. When you're in someone's home, you can really, like, sit in the den, play a board game, see your siblings walking around, interacting with the parents, which I loved about that, because my daughter did date during COVID. And, you're going to learn so much valuable information about the family that person comes from, what their background is, what their relationships are like. And I find that there's a lot of clarity that comes comes from being in the person's home. And just to add to that, I really think that Shabbos is actually a really great time that we don't take enough advantage of. We think Shabbos is a huge step in the relationship, and there are certain communities that spending Shabbos together would really be usur until they're engaged. But I really want to break down that heaviness and the hype about Shabbos being such a big deal. Shabbos is really a great way to get more clarity about a person, because you can be on your best behavior for 3 hours and 4 hours and 5 hours. And one boy told me he was on an 8-hour date yesterday, which is absurd. But for 25 hours, it's much harder to pull off, unless it's real. It was just last week, actually, I encouraged a boy from Chicago who told me that he's not feeling it, he's kind of stuck in the relationship. And I said, I want you to fly in and spend Shabbos with her family. And he's like, are you kidding me? Why would I do that? I don't even know if I like her. I don't even know if I want to progress it. Isn't that going to be like leading her on? And I said, I think you're going to have a lot of clarity from seeing her in her Shabbos, you know, her family. What our weeks revolve around Shabbos, let's be honest. I mean, it's Wednesday, and I haven't done my groceries, and there's a lot of stuff that I need to do for Shabbos that starts like on Sunday. So anyway, he flew in, and he loved her family, and he felt like he really fit in, and he told me he's played a 3-hour game of Settlers with her siblings, and at the end of Shabbos, he called me, and he said, okay, so when can we start talking about the next step? Like, I am sure of it now, and I just really think that's like a fuller picture of what life with that person looks like, and I think that brings clarity, so, okay.
Thank you very much. I don't have much to add, other than the fact that even though I began, and I'll continue to sort of double down on my original claim that I don't really believe in clarity the way it is often referred to, I do think that, something that you shared was very clarifying, elucidating in many ways. A point that just comes to mind that I just want to share with you very briefly is that, we all speak about the concept of Amunah in our relationship with Hashem. It is something that we take for granted, it's something we strive for, and I hope, but I'm going to say it anyway, I hope you all appreciate that Amunah in Hashem is not designed to be what we turn to, when we can't come up with anything else. It's not a b'dieved. It is true there's a concept of trying leida as Hashem, which is the word the rabbi uses in terms of understanding, connecting with HaKadosh Baruch Hu primarily through Torah. And then we do reach a certain point where there's a limit as to what we can know. And then it's not that, now we have no choice, never, but all we're left with is Amunah. That is a stage. That is a component of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I'm speaking in the presence of people who are much greater than that, but it would seem to me that we could consider, a similar model in our relationships in other than particularly within dating, and I would go as far as to say within marriage as well. And one of the important things that I think we want our kids to know is that clarity you may feel that you have, certainty you will never have. And the notion that once we get married, so then, okay, it's smooth sailing from here, everything will be as clear as it could possibly be, only clearer. Anybody here knows that that's not the case. And, I think therefore setting ourselves up for a lifetime in which we're constantly searching for, again, for more clarity in the moment, but being able to find comfort in that place of Amunah, that's something that hopefully, we can apply that construct within this conversation as well. So, if it's okay, I'm going to turn back to Dr. Adler, asking a specific question. Both you and Rabbi Glass mentioned using different terminology, but that there can be, and I would imagine in many instances there are people who either because of their predispositions, because of an actual diagnosis or just a certain personality type of tendency, there are people who tend to obsess more and be more anxious in situations where they're making major decisions or frankly even non-major decisions. So as a psychologist, what do you see as the most common reasons for this decision-making anxiety in relationships, and how can they be overcome? I know that that's a very big question because, there's only so much that you can share with us in this setting, but, I'll ask a related question. At which point should someone consider being referred to or maybe seeking professional counsel themselves for their own anxiety in this area?
So
So, you know, as you said, lots and lots and lots of our children, and probably many of us ourselves, when it comes to dating, have periods of high anxiety. And I think for many, many people, not everyone, but maybe even the majority, there are short periods of spurts of anxiety, often after certain conversations, or you're kind of taking it to a certain level, or you discover there's something a little different about that person that you didn't realize that you have to adjust to or decide whether you accept. Anxiety is a normal part of life if we're actually living our life and doing good things and putting ourselves out there and going on to new experiences. We're going to sometimes have anxiety. I think in terms of reaching the threshold of getting professional help, certainly if our child's anxiety is getting in the way of their functioning for more than a week or two, like they can't study, they can't think, they're edgy and agitated, that would be a good time to get help. Help sometimes could go on for months, and sometimes it might be two or three sessions, but it's a way of getting clarity as to what's going on and sometimes being able to really push through it. I think that Rabbi Blass, Maki, lots of people who are not professionals in terms of, well, Rabbi Blass is licensed, but being licensed professionals, there are lots of people that deal with shidduchim all the time and can also give absolutely amazing advice and help. But if they've gone to their usual resources, or for whatever reason they're not particularly close to somebody who really knows them well, they don't have those resources, and they haven't been able to settle down that internal kind of edgy feeling inside of themselves, it's always a good idea to get a little extra help. One of the biggest causes of anxiety, I think, is the way we frame dating to ourselves, and there may be different ways of saying this. I think it's very romantic and wonderful to think about there being one Beshert, and in a lot of ways, I guess we all have dichotomies of how we think of things. In a lot of ways, I feel that's true. I feel I married my Beshert, and I think that's a wonderful thing that we should all think. On the other hand, when it comes to anxiety and decision-making, I think that that way of seeing shidduchim like a needle in a haystack, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be really messed up if I married the wrong person because there's only one person for me, and if I don't find them, I'm really, I'm a goner. I'm just not going to be happy. That way of thinking about it really creates a lot of unease and unrest within a person, and I don't think it's even accurate or true. I think there's different ways you can think about having a Beshert that combine timing, where you're at the moment, and all different kinds of things that somehow come into this being the right person. But when people are able to think of it not as, oh, there's all this responsibility, I have to decide on the right person out of thousands of people at YU and Stern or wherever they're dating, and instead think about it of making a logical, thought-out, emotionally sound decision based on what's presented to them at the time, it reduces anxiety tremendously. In fact, if you follow a lot of, everybody has their own little tweak on what they call ingredients for a happy relationship, but if you follow most of them, you actually really can't go wrong. If you have the ingredients for a happy relationship and it makes sense well enough, both on paper and with where you're at emotionally, and you're both good people and you have all the stuff, which I'm sure all of us will talk about soon, you create your own reality. That person becomes your Beshert. And when we think of it that way, it reduces anxiety tremendously. The people that I think tend to get stuck the most are people who have anxiety tendencies, as does a high percentage of the Ashkenazic population, and probably really of the world. But generally, being analytical does tend to increase anxiety. And when you think of all the ifs, ands, and buts and all the things that could go wrong and you use your Gemara cup, I find in the firm world it tends to be more often men, but not always, that have anxiety moving forward. It's not always, but more often. So, you know, if you're going to think about everything to the nth degree, there's a lot to be anxious about. So people with anxiety tendencies often really need to learn to live with some level of anxiety, knowing that they're, as Rabbi Plass said so eloquently, they're making a good, sound choice. and it really is going to be okay. It's going to be okay. But yes, there'll be some anxiety until you get used to it, until you transition into it. One of the main questions I ask people when they come to me for help is, how have your decisions been in the past? And almost always, it's like a light bulb goes off. It seems so obvious, but it's not obvious to them when they're in the struggle. Oh, right, I'm always a nervous wreck. It was hard to decide where to go to Israel, and maybe they weren't even sure until they were there for a few months, and it was hard to decide for some of them where to go to college or what their major was going to be or who the chavrusa was going to be. And there are some people, that tends to be more often girls, who even have a hard time deciding what they're going to order at a restaurant and what dress they're going to buy when all 10 look wonderful on them. And when people frame it like that, oh, decision-making is causing me anxiety, but it's not the person. It's the transition into something new. That calms them down a lot. Other big things that come up in therapy are, I'm going to call it like a mismatch in template. A lot of times people have a certain idea in their head, sometimes consciously and sometimes subconsciously, of what that special person is going to be like. And the person in front of them, because, you know, nobody's a Build-A-Bear. They don't have every single element that you thought that you would want. But they could be pretty amazing and meet everything important on your checklist. And you can have a lot of chemistry as well. And everything is really great. But there's something in their template that is, like, making them feel uneasy. The two most common I see in the YUN Stern community are... I know this sounds silly, but it's not when the person's experiencing it, is the person just doesn't have the background that they kind of had in their head. Like, their sisters went to Shalavim, or their brothers went to KBY, or all their social circles, you know, they all know each other from this camp, or from that or this. And the person is not saying, they didn't go to the right camp, so I don't want to marry them. Everyone realizes that's stupid. Okay, but they're noticing that there's, like, a discomfort. It takes them longer than they otherwise would to be comfortable with that person because they don't have the automatic shared frame of reference that helps them kind of place it. It's like, I don't really know. But then if you kind of go through with the person, like, is there anything value-based that this person doesn't have? Like, do they have the values that you wanted when you thought that they were going to go to MMY? Oh, yeah, they have those values. That's who they are. But they didn't go there. They don't know the same people. They don't, you know, do they have the values that you're looking for? Or is the template just symbolic and you just need to adjust to it? Or is the template that's not matching really something important? Another big one is if a lot of people seem to take longer to adjust to a shidduch if the person is different than their same gender siblings. I have noticed that a lot, not always, but if all the guys in their family are machers and this way and that way and they fall for a guy he's creme to the creme, but he's more reserved. It takes them a little longer to wrap themselves around that. Or the other way. The girls and their family are all, you know, high-powered or all sweet and idle, whatever it is. And this girl has all the milas. There's nothing wrong with her. They get along great. Everything matches. But it doesn't feel as familiar. And so that often takes people some thinking through, some working through, some acceptance practices, and sometimes talking it directly through with their parents and with their family. Like, hey, guys, like, are they going to fit in even though they're not in the bumper sticker? Like, you're going to accept them? They're going to still... And most of the time, parents are lovely and wonderful. We're all great, and we give them the reassurance they need. But some people need to go through those steps. The only other thing I would add is that there are people who have relationship wounds. There is something called attachment categories. Many of us might have learned it in psychology, like 101. About 40% of the American public does have some level of attachment insecurity, which is like fancy jargon, but basically means maybe there was a mismatch with them and their parents. They didn't feel that unconditional love, even if their parents are wonderful people and didn't do anything horrible, but they kind of felt criticized or not quite the way they wanted to feel growing up. Or maybe their parents weren't so wonderful and, you know, they didn't get to know one of them very well. They felt betrayed in some way. Or maybe they have relationship wounds from their own previous romantic relationships. They were about to get engaged and somebody dropped them, or they found out something very distressing that was a secret. Those are relationship wounds, and people who have relationship wounds sometimes can work it through on their own and with a really good mentor, but more often they do better when they get some professional help. Sometimes it's not long. It doesn't have to be months or years, but there are techniques that we can use that help people repair their wounds to some extent and also help them separate this relationship from their previous experiences in relationships. People have a hard time trusting that this is really good if they've had a lot of experiences or important experiences where they thought it was good and then it wasn't. And so some people need like a little extra help getting through that. Most people can get through that, and they're not doomed to bad relationships, but they need a little extra encouragement and help to work that through.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to go a little bit off script over here for the next question. You know, that was It was a very substantive answer. It was clinically driven, as it should be, because I actually said, as a psychologist. And although you really, I think you made it very understandable and relatable for each and every one of us, it did include a lot of potential conversations with young men and women in the dating process who would already be interacting with you or maybe a colleague in some sort of professional setting. So my question, this is a jump ball for either of Glass and Malki, either one of you can take the lead or answer this entirely. You know, when someone is 1, 2, 3 dates in, and some of these questions are coming up, I don't know, like you said, you know, some of the examples that we would, in the big scheme of life, really silly, so I shouldn't go to MMY. But, you know, he's stuck on it. Is it, at that point, is it your particular approach? Do you recommend to us, to any one of us in our capacities, as friends, as parents, perhaps as aspiring shadchanim, to say no, like really, and to let's take out a piece of paper, or were these conversations that should only be happening if they're taking the lead, or maybe farther into the relationship? Wait a second, you've been going up for 2 or 3 months right now, and you're going to end it because you're going to go to MMY. Let's sit down. Let's really, like, what's going on here? So I'm curious what you do and what you recommend.
Okay, I guess I got this one. This is on, right? Okay. Now it's working. No, it's not working.
Keep pressing the magic button.
I don't know.
Send that one down.
Thank you. This one. Okay, so the question is, you're asking if a person... if a person isn't feeling it, is that what you're...
Early on in the dating process, I said 1, 2, 3, but, you know, it's going to vary from person to person, community to community. But somebody who's not, certainly not committed, but is getting stuck on some of the smaller stuff that at the end of the day might not be, you know, is it our role, is it appropriate for us to push them, to sort of lead them, or say, you know what, okay, like, this is not what he wants, or it's not what she wants, and... I'm going to get out of the way.
Well, one thing that I've learned is that you can't want this more than they do. And I think that that's a really important thing to try to realize when we're, you know, when we're working with somebody, is that we can show them that. And I love that term, the mismatch and template, because that's something that happens a lot. You know, sometimes when they're telling me I don't feel it, I really go back to say, what you seem to have an image of what this person was going to look like, and this doesn't match the image. And I love that, like, you know, not like the male siblings in the family. I find that all the time. Like, my brother was, you know, is super tall, and this guy's my height. Or, you know, my brother is a madrich on NCSY Kollel, and this boy didn't go on NCSY Kollel. You know, it's sorry, Andrew. and, you know, I definitely redirect them, and a lot of times it's, I'll take it one step further, and it's a lot of times it's not what their friends think is for them. You know, their friends always pictured them with this type of guy, and I think Rabbi Daniel Feldman, who calls it Re'ias Chaverim, like that's a term that he coined, which I think is great. And sometimes I bring that to them, and I said, so we're ending this because this isn't what your friends pictured for you. I don't really think that that's a value. Like, I don't really think that that's a Jewish value. I don't think that's your value either. But then it comes to a point where I'm not going, so you're asking, like, should I push them or do I let it go? And I feel like if I'm bringing this to your attention and you're realizing it and you're hearing me and this resonates and you're still not willing to move forward, then my job, at least as a shadchan, I mean, obviously aside from referring to people like the mashgichim at YU and to therapists, yeah, right, is to just say, like, I can't want this more than you do. I can't be pushing you harder than you want to go. So my role would be to just say, like, it's your decision. You're the expert in your life. And if you feel like this isn't something that you can handle right now, then I just have to take a back seat and just say, I may disagree, but it's your life. So that would be my answer.
Okay. I can't move on to the next section without just commenting. I'm so happy that you quoted Rabbi Feldman, who has spoken on many occasions about this, a very unfortunate phenomenon in our community, where someone's friends don't think it's a good idea. That can come from different places, different histories. He refers to it as the "it's not shy" phenomenon. Who says, well, it's just not shy? He has pointed out, and I would encourage you, if you're in a position when you're discussing this with someone, again, not for the purpose of pushing them, but just helping them consider another perspective. This may not fit in every home, but my wife is here, and we actually celebrated our 29th anniversary yesterday. Happily married, but I will say, if you know my wife and I, you know that it's not shy. There's really very little about our relationship that Shach doesn't make sense on paper, but Baruch Hashem, you know, it's working for us and our children, and you know, we're very happy, and we wouldn't change anything if we could. And this notion that you can just sort of define a relationship, even beforehand, but even after the fact, and saying this is Shach, it's terribly misguided. And I appreciate the fact that you said it doesn't seem to be reflective of Torah, Balance Torah Shkaf in any way. And unfortunately, it's a very prevalent trend within our community. And all we can do is be aware of it and try to create a counter trend, but I think it's a very good problem. I have found with young men in particular, they can be sometimes, in some cases, simply immovable. If they come to the decision that it's not Shayach, and most often that's coming from a comment or two that was coming from friends who claim to know the people well. So, something else.
I just want to add something you said before. First of all, I had the great pleasure of being at your wedding 29 years ago. I hope that your marital bliss will in no way be diminished after claiming that you and Khalifa are not shy together. But I'll leave it up to the two of you to navigate, as we all do. But just something you mentioned before, Arthrax, and your typical thoughtfulness was about Amunah and Hashem turning to a Kodesh Baruch Hu, not just Pesara, but just to sort of have these conversations to allow for clarification. I think a lot of that also, at different stages, especially towards a later stage of relationship, is a person to really have a bitachon that we can build a great marriage, right? There's not certainty, there's not some 100% revelation, but there's a real sense of, like, do I trust myself? Do I trust her? Do I trust us as a couple to build something in the next 70, 80 years? And for our young men and women to feel confident in themselves. And obviously, as Dr. Adler said, if there's serious red flags, mental health issues, maybe serious family issues, serious undealt trauma, then it becomes very, very difficult. But in most relationships, that has a good foundation to have real bitachon that we can build something beautiful between us and to like empower like our children in a way to sort of feel that they can be like a conductor, so to speak, of their own futures in that sense. Just wanted to add that as well.
Thank you. Okay, so we're going to now move to the next segment of this conversation. We're talking about the role of parents in the dating process. Looking out of the room, I don't want to get any assumptions as to why someone's here. You could be here for many reasons, but I definitely see parents in the room. And I think what we're about to discuss is important not only for parents, but it's important for daters. It's important for aspiring parents. It's important for young women. And I think it's a very, very important conversation. In some ways, perhaps, really will make everything else that was discussed until now most relevant. I'm going to start now with Rabbi Glass, if that's okay. What do you think should be the role of parents in the dating process?
Go. Nice, simple question. Revolvi describes in a different context about a ship trying to make it through the Straits of Gibraltar without moving in one direction too much in regards to Gaiva, in one direction too much in regards to something else. You're just trying to sort of get that ship somehow through this perilous state of, you know, the Straits of Gibraltar. That's what I feel sometimes as a parent. And Baruch Hashem, I have wonderful children. I want to give a very special thank you to Malki for spending many, many hours with one of my wonderful kids, and to Efrat as well.
And that is the navigation, sort of like the dance that all of us are always trying to navigate between being very, very mindful of boundaries, right? This is either not my place, I want to pull back, I want to sort of show my concern, I want to give them my space, I want to allow them to be independent, I want to make sure that they don't feel beholden to, and be very mindful of boundaries. And I have to say, not necessarily people in this room, but a lot of parents have a very, very, very challenging time with boundaries. I one time spoke to a mother of a wonderful Talmud at NYU, and she called me up and she said, "Oh, I know you're very close with so-and-so. He's starting to date, and I want to stay out of this whole process. And he, I totally trust him. There's only one condition, that he lives down the block from us in Los Angeles, and he's going to move there next year." I'm like, "Oh, well, it's a good thing you're staying out of the process, demanding that he lives three doors down. But other than that, you're totally not involved." And I'm like, "Oh, gosh, this poor guy and this poor girl. They moved to Los Angeles." She said, within a year, we need them to be moving to Los Angeles next to us. But other than that, I'm not involved." I'm like, "Oh, gosh." So how do we sort of really respect our kids' boundaries? That's number one. And the flip side of that is how to continue to sort of be a very meaningful voice in their ear in a process that they really do often need support in. So the opposite of boundaries is not sort of abdicating responsibility, right? It's being there. And it's very complicated. I should say that I spend many hours every week speaking to parents who call me and say, "Listen, I know you're close to my son. I don't know how to deal with him because it's going month after month after month. Should I talk to him? Should I leave him alone? Is he in good hands? Is he freaking out? What should we be doing? How do I support him?" It is very complicated, and I know my own life, dealing with my kids, it's very, very complicated. I would just say, and again, there's so much to say on this topic, and I don't want to take too much time, is that I think in most cases, kids can sort of figure this out with warm support from parents and mentors and Rebbeim and YU Connects and a good therapist, Dr. Aller, sees so many of our young men. To sort of parents have to back up and allow kids to navigate through that. And at the same time, parents have a lot more experience. And I would just mention maybe, as Chatzai and Maskir, that there's been situations over the years where I thought that the best thing was for the couple to break up. I even was close, Dr. Aller can't do, but I could do, of recommending that they break up. And then the couple got married and they had a beautiful marriage. And I was happy that I just sort of kept my mouth closed. But there's other times where somebody is so unhappy for so many months and they're so stressed out and they're anxious, and this should not be an unhappy process. And I spoke to somebody a day before their wedding, 2 days before their wedding. He said, "You know what? I'm just going to do it," right? And I told him, I said, "Listen, you do whatever you want to do, but obviously you still have a choice to back up now." And he was so anxious. And looking back now, I wish I had pushed him. They've been married for X amount of years. They have a very, very unhappy marriage. He feels very stuck. And both myself, as sort of his Rebbe, and his parents, who are amazing people, felt that they didn't want to overstep. And maybe sometimes it is our role to overstep. We know a lot more about relationships and unhealthy people and how a relationship should feel, and how to sort of navigate when to move forward, when to move backwards. And that's true in every piece of our kids' life, never more so than when it comes to issues of relationships.
If I may, I just want to add one maybe qualification. I was feeling myself get a little anxious, as Rabbi Blass mentioned, his desire to step in. But he makes a very good point, and that is that there are times. There are times where anyone, it's a possible, Samana Damriach, if you see somebody that's about to make a very poor choice, this notion of just respecting boundaries and minding your own business. I would just make a suggestion before doing that, and this applies really, I think, to anyone, including parents, because I agree with everything Rabbi Blass said, and that is that if you think it's such a situation that calls for such an intervention, ask somebody else. Ask somebody else who's not involved in the way that you are. Get an objective opinion. It doesn't necessarily have to be a professional opinion, but it should be a decision that's coming from a responsible individual, somebody who can really, really let you know whether or not this is a situation where, in fact, it does call for saying, I'm very, very, very concerned about this, and maybe you really, even encourage them not to go through it. Because as a general rule, I feel strongly, again, I'm not a panelist tonight, so I can say whatever I want, I feel very strongly that parents really should not be telling their kids what to do once they reach a certain age, with very, very rare exceptions. Some would say that's radical. I don't think it's radical at all. I actually think that's, we can talk about it for longer if anybody wants to challenge about it. But I really think that generally we should really, really, really not tell our kids what to do when it comes to adult decisions. But we should be there, as Rebbe Blass said, to advise and to guide and support. But in those moments where we think, oh my gosh, so then we, unless it's as clear as day, and I'm not really sure that we should ever trust ourselves, or it's a decision that requires an immediate on-the-spot decision, that we should consult. Okay, so let me move to Malki now and ask you again. I don't want to repeat the same question, although you may have, if there's anything you have to add to what Rebbe Blass said in terms of the role of parents, I probably could just leave it at that. Yeah, let's just do that. Yes. Malki, what should be the role of parents? Or maybe I'll say for you, what shouldn't be the role of parents in the process? Let's pass the mic down.
Okay, so firstly, this is a question that I get a lot because as the as the child starting to date, the mother, the father, whatever they'll usually call me, and they'll say, what should be my role? How involved should I be? How do I have these conversations? And I always start off by saying that your relationship with your child does not start with the dating process. You know, this needed to have started, 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And the conversations that you're having, your child being involved in your child's life, conversations about decisions, that's when they're going to want to come to you at this point, when you've already built that relationship, and that relationship and foundation is very, very strong. But I say, anyways, This process is obviously a very confusing one, and I find that we've grabbed some things from like the yeshivish world, and we really don't know how to place them in our world. And there's a lot of confusion about what the parents' role is, because we're using a little bit of the model, but not all of the model. So I think it's about having really just a conversation with your child and say, exactly this. What would you like my role to be in your dating? In some worlds, the yeshivish world, basically the parent will be in contact with the shadchan. We find in the YU world, that's really not the most effective. We find it's not the best use of our time. It's not really what works best for the daters. So we would encourage the daters themselves to reach out and talk to us. And sometimes your son or daughter might come to you and say, Mom, I've got this. I really want to start this process on my own. Maybe I don't want to go to shadchanim. I want to speak to friends. Or maybe I want to reach out to them myself, and I'd like you to take a back seat. So there could always be a plan B if plan A is not working. But I think it's important to follow what your adult child is asking of you in terms of this process. And, Rebbe Blass says that he speaks to parents a lot. I have parents sometimes calling me saying, don't tell my son or daughter that I'm calling you. And I just, smile, and I'm like, how is this going to be helpful? Do you want me to just cold call your child and just say, I just happen to have your phone number in my phone, and I think it's important for us to talk. I mean, I think that we're really missing the beginning part of the conversation where the parent needs to be on board with the child. It's not helpful in any way to kind of go behind your child's back and try to navigate the system without them. And one really important point that I really wanted to make about the parent's role in dating, and this is something that I've been wanting to say in a public forum like this for a very long time, so I really appreciate having your attention right now. All of us are parents of sons and daughters. And I would venture to say that we have an equal number of sons and daughters in this room. It's really time to level the playing fields. Our sons and daughters are all amazing, and they're all high caliber, and one is not better than the other. And I find that people call us all the time about their daughters. They track us down. They need us to help them. And we are always absolutely more than happy to help. You know, I love girls. You know, I'm happy to be talking to them all day long. But sometimes we find out that those same parents that are tracking us down about their daughters, they have sons who are dating, and they're not really sharing that with us. And if we ask about their sons, they'll say, like, oh, no, he likes to go through friends, or I'm not worried about him. He has lots of ideas, but let's just focus on my daughter. And if you think for a minute that if everyone is doing this, and everyone is doing this, who are we setting our daughters up with? So as a community, I really, really am asking that we need to start using the same playing fields for both. If it's good enough for our daughters, and that's the system that we're choosing for our daughters, we need to choose the same system for our sons and just make things easier for our daughters by also calling us about our sons. And really encourage and insist, like, this is a good time to be a good role model to your sons, that they can use the same system that their daughters are using, because we don't have anyone to set them up with if the sons are not accessible. I also have a son, and when he starts to date, I really intend to call the same shadchanim that set up my daughter and have them set him up in the same way. And sometimes they'll tell me, like, oh, our sons are saying, I don't do this through shadchanim. And you can just say, why not? Like, if that's the system that your sister is using, why not? Why not for you? I was setting up a girl last week, and I called a boy. And the boy says to me, oh, I sit next to her brother in the base medrash. And I said, oh, how cute. That mother called me and asked me to meet her 20-year-old daughter, but didn't mention that she has a 23-year-old son that's also dating. And you can't really say, like, my son doesn't need ideas, but my daughter does. Because when we talk like that, we're really inflating one side, and we're not giving enough cover to our daughters. And this doesn't just go for mothers. It really goes for aunts that are calling us about their nieces. Like, don't you also have nephews? And grandmothers do have grandsons. And I really feel, and I appeal to you, as a community, I think that we can really change this and really bring back, like, the rightful prestige and honor that our daughters really deserve. So, that's nice. Hey.
Thank you very much. Maybe I'll turn now. You know, we've started with the psychologist on the panel for the first few questions, but for this last question, maybe Dr. Adler, if you can just discuss the difference, or maybe what would be sort of the balance that we would want to achieve between parental advice and the autonomy of the individual making baby decisions. I don't know if there's any research or experience, anecdotal experience that you can share with us, sort of the good, the bad, and the ugly, best practices, and what really doesn't work. You alluded to it. I don't want to tell you what you alluded to. You know, attachment injuries. I imagine that they're not necessarily always occurring during the dating process, but, you know, maybe some of that, those similar dynamics that are going on when kids are 2, 3, 4, 5 years old at home, and they do really affect, perhaps, the development of the child, the way they relate to themselves and other relationships. So please, enlighten us, instruct us, we are here to learn.
Okay. That's so exciting. I might go on for 3 hours. Okay. But I won't. I was told to be brief. So I think in terms of looking out how parents can find the boundaries, like promoting autonomy, but still being able to help all of us to still be able to help our children, I think it's important to think about what is a healthy way to help our children. It's obviously not to make decisions for them, as much as we want to. but what do we want to do? So one, I think many of us, hopefully all of us, have a lot of white life wisdom that we want to share with them. We really do have perspective and a sense of what tends to be good, what not doesn't tend to be good. We might even have insight into our child. So we want to be able to be there for them in that way. And also, I think that we can educate ourselves and then help educate our children about what makes for good relationships and what it really is important to look for in a spouse. And, you know, a lot of our children just kind of gain that, Baruch Hashem, by osmosis. Often, even without having a conversation, they have seen a good relationship hopefully they all have, and they kind of know what feels right and what doesn't, but unfortunately not all of our children have, and there might have been periods in our life where they saw things that might not be great for them, or there might be a dynamic that's not amazing. I think it's very important for parents to have a frank discussion, not with TMI, but with their children. I've had many clients who wish that their parents would have said, you know, mommy and Abba, like, we have this dynamic. It's not horrible, but it's not amazing. And I, you know, we didn't know about this, that, or the other, or how to navigate, you know, in-law relationships, or how to navigate this, or how to navigate that. We hope that you'll do better. or we'd like to provide resources if you would like to be able to get more about it. There are so many books out there, and there's so much that we can learn about. A lot of it's from Why You Connect, about having healthy relationships. I think one of the primary ways that we can help our children is by discussing beforehand what they're looking for, not only focusing on the resume, although a resume is important. There should be things in common. They should have a common trajectory. But I feel like what's much more important than that, even though that is important, is the quality of the relationship that they see themselves having with this potential dater. And I tell people this all the time when they ask. Yes, everything should line up and be somewhat logical, et cetera, of course. But I know so many people, yourselves, myself, and my husband, so many people I know who have so many personal differences and are so happy. What makes people happy is the quality of the relationship, not whether they have all the same hobbies and all the same interests and went to all the same schools. That can add, it can contribute. But there is actual research, which I wish more of us were aware of and can share with our children. It's not theories about what makes relationship happy. There's actual research, incontrovertible, about what makes people more likely to have happy marriages. And I think that's what we should share with our kids. And when we ask them questions, that's more of what we should be asking about. And it's in black and white. There's lots of bestsellers. John Gottman is a big marriage therapist, has written a ton about it. And again, it's not his theory. He's done actual research, longitudinal, which is following couples for years and years and years. And he has found that the highest rate of divorce or unhappy marriages is people with poor communication skills, primarily criticism, defensiveness, stonewalling, which is when you just refuse to talk about things and give the silent treatment, and contempt. Contempt is rolling your eyes, big sighs, all sorts of things that make the person feel like they're a person non grata when they have communication issues. Contempt is high levels of contempt when there's disagreement about issues has a 94% correlation with eventual divorce. It's huge. I think we should be asking our children, when you guys disagree about something, that's not a problem. We all have differences. Every marriage, every person has differences. How do you disagree? How do you repair afterwards? Do you feel like they hear you and respect you, even if they have a totally different way of saying things? We should be interested in the ways in which our potential couple have differences and how they navigate those differences, because research shows that's much more important than their similarities. The seven things that have been correlated to increased marital satisfaction, some of them are a little bit in jargon, so they're a little harder to understand, but it's something called love maps. That has to do with how interested you are in your partner's interest, not how interested you actually are. It doesn't matter if you like ballet or you like this year. You're interested in that they're interested. How did that ballet show go to, even though you couldn't care less about it? Oh, I know you love that speaker. I saw that they're speaking, and I forwarded you the email. Understanding what makes your partner tick is highly correlated, and caring, even if you don't really care, is highly correlated to marital success. Nurturing fondness and admiration. It's a style. It's a comfort. It's a way of being. Even when there's differences. Yeah, my wife gets lost a lot. It's cute. Instead of, you know, turning towards each other for support instead of turning away. Letting ourselves be influenced by our spouse. Solving solvable problems, having a can-do attitude. Oh, okay, you know, we could probably figure that out. Let's compromise. Let's figure it out together. Overcoming gridlock when there are differences, and creating shared sense of meaning, which is all about the future. Having experiences and memories that you then reminisce about and talk about and are meaningful to you. Those are the factors that make for healthy marriages. It's also nice if you happen to like the same CRM and you happen to like the same hobbies and you can talk about your, you know, Rebbe or friend from camp that you both have a shared experience with. It's more comfortable, but it actually has no correlation that I've ever seen with whether you actually end up being happy. And I think that it's really important for our kids to know that, and also to know that differences are not scary and necessarily a reason not to be together. It's the navigation of the differences and appreciating what you each bring to the table that is very, very important. And the last thing I would say that we shouldn't do, that was a do, we should emphasize the quality of the relationship and ask them open-ended questions that get to the quality of the relationship. Did you feel respected even though he thought you were coming from another planet and had a totally different way of seeing it? Did you feel safe to still say what you felt? The other thing that we should do, and I'm not doing it now because I'm getting very intense, we should not be intense when we talk to our children. I am not intense as a therapist. I try not to be intense as a parent. Sometimes I have to hold myself back, as we all do. I am intense about and passionate about ideas, but this is a different forum. Lots and lots of times parents will say to me, like, I'm glad you're working with my kid. I don't really understand, like, exactly what they're getting. Like, you say exactly what I say, but, like, they listen to you. You don't get in a fight about it. The difference is the tenor and the level of intensity. And parents will say, I can't help getting intense because it's important. So I always say, and no matter how amazing our parents are, I'm sure all of our parents are absolutely amazing, but we all have experiences of our own parents being intense when they're giving us shidduchim advice when we were younger, or career advice, or financial advice, or what we should do with our children. Whatever it is, no matter how amazing our parents are, we probably have all had experiences where we wish they would, like, lay off a little bit. And I ask people to close their eyes and think, when your parent gets intense with you, or when your employer does, or when your spouse does, how do you react? Do you say, that's amazing, thank you for that idea? Or what you probably do, because we have general reactions when we feel overwhelmed by people's advice, we either shut down, we kind of get, like, literally our prefrontal cortex closes down, our amygdala, which is danger and anxiety, gets raised, and we blank out like a deer in a headlights, like, and we don't take in anything they're saying, we just want them to stop and end, okay? Or we appease them, we yes them, we all do that to our parents sometimes, yeah, mom, yeah, of course, oh yeah, and then we don't listen to anything they're saying because it was overwhelming and too much and not where we were at. Or we get argumentative and tell them they don't know what they're talking about, et cetera, et cetera. Either way, we shut down conversation. They definitely don't want to call us again and tell us what happened on their next date. we shut down conversation, or we actually shut down our children's ability to problem solve and think, because they are so overwhelmed by having to manage our emotions. Like, they have to damage control us, that they're not able to own what they actually want to do in the situation or to take in our advice. So even though I was very intense now, I think the best thing that we can do at all ages, and definitely for shidduchim, is even if we have strong ideas, and even if we're 100% right, like anyone would agree that we're right, we have to get out our intensity on our spouse, on our best friend, on our therapist, call up the mashgiach, do whatever you need to do. And when we talk to your child, and you can literally practice in the car, on your way home from work, or in the mirror, you need to sound calm, cool, and collected. Also, honey, I was, like, just kind of thinking about what you said. You know, it's just kind of interesting. It wasn't what I originally thought, you know, whatever. And practice sounding reasonable, like you might be if it was your friend's child instead of your child. And that's the way you keep the dialogue going. An exception would be if, God forbid, there really is a risk of abuse and you've already tried to be calm, cool, and collected and there really is an emergency. That is so rare. I actually think that all of our children, for the most part, are pretty amazing. They really are, girls and boys. Mm-hmm. Most of the people that our children date are very high caliber. I mean, look at their parents. It is very rare that someone comes to my office, at least, and the reason they're having difficulty with their decisions is because there's, like, major red flags. It's occasional. But usually they're nice, good people. There's no emergency. Whatever they decide will probably be okay. And the more we keep that perspective when we talk to our kids, the more they actually will want to tell us what's going on and want our insight and advice. And that's how we keep boundaries and we keep from making decisions for them.
I wasn't asking. Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to push back just a little bit on what. I just want to push back a little bit just on what Rabbi Rothbeck said. First, everything that Dr. Adler said and Rabbi Rothbeck as well is certainly incredibly thoughtful and excellent. I think the one thing I would say, which I disagree a little bit, is that If let's say we're speaking about a child who is 24, 25, 26 years old, in a relationship, maybe struggling with a whole host of things. Maybe they're dealing with untreated ADHD. Maybe they're stuck in a depression. Maybe they're not functioning properly. I think if like we as parents have spent our lifetime with healthy relations with our kids, not overstating our opinions, minding our boundaries, letting our kids be their own autonomous beings, then there are times in our life where we can sort of then step forward and say, listen, you know, can we have a conversation? I am concerned. Are you open to hearing that? And obviously, that has to be sort of with their permission. But I do think that there are times in life where our kids are really struggling. And, you know, it's our... And it... Oh, sorry. I don't know what happened. And it is our role to step forward if the relationship allows for it. And if you see your kids like struggling over and over and over again, or in unhealthy relationships, or dating a girl who's not a balas midos, and you're concerned about it, you know, if you've laid the groundwork for 20 plus years of what a healthy relationship looks like, then like you've created now the framework where your child can now listen to you in those moments. If you've abused that, so then you can't say one word to your kid. I mean, parents who have not have established good boundaries can barely say good morning without their 23-year-old child wanting to escape because they feel so suffocated and paralyzed by their parents. And that's very challenging if that's been the pattern for 20, 25 years. But if there's a different pattern, so then often kids may welcome that involvement from parents. But again, it's obviously a very delicate situation.
Of course, everybody here would love it if I would disagree with her at the last nap. That would be really newsworthy. Unfortunately, we agree 100%. What I had said, and again, I'm happy to think about this more another time, because now I'm trying to say, parents should not make their children's decisions for them. And you know, that's pretty much the entirety of my argument. But of course, we can, and we should, certainly not just avail ourselves and offer, but in some cases, even impose, particularly when we have concerns, especially if they're at risk in certain ways, as the class mentioned, for sure. But we should make their decisions for them, because I find that most often they're asking us to do so because they don't want to have to do that themselves. And I don't think that, like, if all of our panelists, I don't really think that that's really, you know, what responsible parenting is. Or it's because of the fact that we are afraid of the, you know, we want them to make a certain decision for our own interests, but we can't, you know, trust them to make their own personal autonomy in that process. So, but I absolutely agree that we shouldn't stand back and stand by and watch our kids, you know, God forbid, you know, make major, you know, life decisions that are not in the best interest. I think we probably do agree at a time. Let me ask a question to the audience before we stop. And that is, you know, we came in tonight to discuss, what is clarity in dating. So, just by a show of hands, who has clarity now? Oh no. Oh, Alan! Thank you! Okay, so Alan has clarity. That's wonderful. The rest of us are not quite sure. Or again, what we've learned tonight from all of our panelists is that, you know, maybe it just depends how you define the word clarity. I'll actually conclude, I rarely do this, but I'll conclude by referencing one of the, I think even perhaps one of the most romantic scenes that I've ever seen in any movie. In any movie, don't get nervous. I'm just on those feet. I promise you, this is about as clean as I get. But in that very famous scene in Fiddler on the Roof, where Tevye, I think that's his name, right? Says, Golda, do you love me? And she didn't really know how to answer the question. And it's a beautiful song. It's absolutely brilliant. There's a tremendous amount of depth to that song and that dialogue. But she basically says, I don't know. And she's trying to work it through. Like, you know, for 25 years, I washed your clothes, and I cooked your food, and I built your clothes. Yeah, so I guess I love you. And he's like, well, I guess I love you too. And love and clarity in certain respects are, you know, similar types of words. You know, do we have clarity? Do we not have clarity? Well, it maybe depends on what you mean, or what you think you mean, or what somebody else means. It's a dangerous word, you know, because it means different things to different people, so we should be careful how we use it and how we understand it. But I do think that tonight's conversation was very clarifying, really very, very illuminating in many ways. I want to thank all of our panelists for their words of wisdom.
Jews and so much more, and want to thank, of course, White Events for opening this conversation, and I'm looking forward to participating. Thank you.